if you could imagine, these are like two mountain peaks. On mountain peak number one, you have $100 billion. Mountain peak number two, you have all the developers and investors. And they really want to get across, but there's no bridge, there's no airplane, there's no helicopter to get across. Right. And we're trying to be that bridge helicopter plane to get across. And I think the opportunity is basically making it more easier to find and use all of those opportunities that exist on the other mountaintop.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Atif Khader is the co-founder and CEO of Redist, a venture-backed fintech company focused on real estate incentives. He is also the co-producer and host of American Building, a real estate podcast that Redist sponsors with Michael Graves Architecture and Design. Some other fun facts about Atif is he's a licensed architect turned developer turned entrepreneur. He's also a real estate agent and a city planner on the Planning Commission. He's seen this industry from every angle. Atif, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me here, Sam.
Hey, man, the pleasure's mine. The same three questions I ask every guest who comes on the show. Can you very quickly tell us in 90 seconds or less where you started, where you are now, and how you got there?
Mm-hmm. Started in a far-off country called Bahrain. In America, my family got green cards to come here during the Iran-Iraq war. So classic American dream story. Three suitcases, three kids, $3,000. And now our family, it's like 9, 10 Ivy League degrees. All of us are C-suite execs. We did it. And it was the classic. We did it. Hard work, ingenuity, perseverance. That's it. And I would say that in a nugget, in a kernel, is the answer to every possible question that I could answer about me and my career and where I've been. But long story short, I'm an architect through and through. That's my educational technical background. And I've used that skill set of being really good at problem solving in both a traditional design sense, construction sense, and now the really unique aspects of development and then into startups.
Wow, man, that's a lot of moving pieces there. And, you know, not necessarily where we should take this today, because we could focus in on one for, you know, a couple hours, if, you know, and do 7 episodes out of this. And maybe we'll have to, you know, but let's talk really about kind of the progression of your business and tell us, maybe give us some insight into what it is, maybe more specifically, when you say development, what is it you're doing today?
Sure. So the majority of my time is focused on growing a venture-backed software business. And I know that sounds really unusual for someone that is an architect and considers themselves a real estate guy, but if you kind of humor me for a second, I think that when you look at our industry, the construction industry overall, we're the largest industry in the United States. We're the largest contributor to the GDP. We're the largest employer. Right. We touch every other industry in the United States. Yet when you think about innovation and cutting edge, pioneering ingenuity in our industry, most people will pause and be like, what? And I think for us, that's a big problem, but also a really big opportunity. And for me in particular, when I was a traditional developer, either at Extel Development, so super famous developer based in New York, and then started my own firm, what I saw is that there were so many inefficiencies in this entire process. And there was one in particular that I really honed in on, and that was the financing or the capitalizing of deals. So I know all your listeners, both of us have had that problem. We have that problem every single deal. That's the problem. How do you capitalize your deal? And one thing in particular that I found is that there is this thing called the government, and they give out money, and it's called public incentives. And most people have no clue what the whole broad sweep of this is, including me as well. And it wasn't until I dove deep into this and saw this entire world that existed of $100 billion a year. And that's why I chose to focus on that. So that's where I spend the majority of my time, is growing and building this technology business.
What was the opportunity you saw when building this technology business?
Mm-hmm. So I saw it from this idea of being able to connect a resource with someone that needs that resource. Right. And right now, if you could imagine, these are like two mountain peaks. On mountain peak number one, you have $100 billion. Mountain peak number two, you have all the developers and investors. And they really want to get across, but there's no bridge, there's no airplane, there's no helicopter to get across. Right. And we're trying to be that bridge helicopter plane to get across. And I think the opportunity is basically making it more easier to find and use all of those opportunities that exist on the other mountaintop.
Yeah. And that sounds cool in principle or in, you know, idea. Mm-hmm. Walk us through that. How does someone finance their deals in 2022 using public incentives?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that that's a really important question to ask. And the idea is the way that we traditionally think of capitalizing deals is debt and equity. And if you're like most developers, you try to ratchet up the debt and you try to minimize the equity, and that's how you juice your returns. Incredibly dangerous strategy, especially if you're building into an economic depression, which who knows what it is that we're going into, this weird thing that this is. Right. But we've all been here. If you're at least in your mid-30s, then you know what the global financial crisis was. And then if you're in your mid-40s, you know what the tech boom and bust was for the real estate industry. So the idea is, how do you take a more conservative approach and one that actually thinks for the long term as opposed to thinking maybe very much on the short term in terms of that idea that we just described? And there are all of these financial resources that can both reduce your requirements for debt and equity, decrease your operating costs, or increase your income in order to improve your IRR, improve your return on equity, or improve your yield. And those are the suite of things that we call public incentives. So there's about 17 different categories that we found, we've cataloged across the US. And the most common ones are ones that are tax credits. And tax credits typically are opportunities to reduce your tax obligation and fill in the blank in terms of what tax obligation that is.
That's really interesting. I mean, it seems like this league of public incentives that you're referring to has always been kind of reserved for the people who are connected, right? Mm-hmm. People like, oh, that's the mayor's brother-in-law. Of course, mm-hmm. you know, he wins the big project with all the mm-hmm. tax credits and things like that. How are you working around the kind of crony capitalist, you know, side of this that tends to exist?
I would say this, and take a step back. I feel like as widely divided as our country is on every single issue that exists, there's one thing I think that combines all types of people together, and it's using government money. So public incentives. So whether you are an incredible progressive that believes that housing is a human right, blah, 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 cancel the rent, all of that stuff, and I'm sure sends a shiver down this everyone that's listening on this show, right. Or you're the other extreme where you're a libertarian, you believe that government should be obligated to show the results of every single dollar of taxpayer money that's spent. Right. I actually consider myself half progressive, half libertarian after having started Redist. And I think once you set that sort of tone and that sort of reality, the idea is that you want to be able to get around all these things that prevent both the housing being accessible for all different types of people, that's crony capitalism, right. Or the ability to make sure that every single dollar of taxpayer money is accounted for and used correctly, that's crony capitalism, that's preventing that too. And for us, it's about following the data. So, and I know that's something that people may have heard with other aspects of technology, but I think particularly in our industry and particularly in this niche, that's what's important. So it's about being able to collect all the information that exists related to public incentives, deliver that in a way that makes sense to our customers who are just like me and you that are developers and investors, and give them and help them and lead them through all the steps that they need in order to get beyond the, oh, hey, yeah, all of that stuff, which is normally the way it's done.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that, you know, I think a lot of people shy away from this is just the complexity of it. Mm-hmm. You know, they say, hey, you know, there are tax credits available. There is the low income housing tax credit, you know, program, things like that, which we own some LIHTC property. And it's very complex. It's a complex reporting. There's complex. Mm-hmm. I mean, even after you're through the initial tax credit phase, there's still a long period of hold where you still have to report and do a lot of, you're jumping through a lot of hoops. So a lot of people, I think, just go, you know what, that's too complicated. The juice is not worth the squeeze. How do you help people kind of work their way around that?
I would say this. Have you ever spent time in like Allentown, Bethlehem in Pennsylvania? Have you ever been there?
No.
Okay, so this past year, I did essentially 12 road trips because for Redist, we decided to work from home. So I had the opportunity to work from home in all different places. So I went places I'd never been before. So I spent one of the 12 months I spent in Allentown, Bethlehem, which is steel country. This is the foundation of the American industrial era. This is the foundation of our industry. It's steel. And when you get a chance to tour all of that, you learn about all of the miraculous ingenuity that went through going from iron, which has specific limits in terms of what you can build, the height, the size, and everything, to steel, which essentially is the foundation of why New York City looks the way that it does, or why LA looks the way that it does, because of the ability to go really tall. That is tough. Coming up with that and producing steel is tough. figuring out incentives is not tough in comparison. So I think once we level set the incredible leaps that our industry has made, I think it's important to understand that this is a problem that we can solve if we put our minds to it and we focus on it. And I think that I understand, because I'm a developer too, that people don't have the time to spend years coming up with a master's degree in tax credits. That's irrelevant and stupid. But I think the idea is to take a moment and think about what could be done with this money, and then taking the opportunity that exists through a company like Redis to be able to take that to the next level and effectively identify and apply for tax credits and everything else that you're eligible for. And just suspending disbelief for a moment that public incentives are all gobbledygook, that's crony capitalism. It shouldn't be that way.
Let's talk about competition then. Mm-hmm. I hear, you know, that tax credits especially are a highly competitive thing. So how do you help people work their way around, you know, that kind of need, or not need, but just the highly competitive environment that it is?
Let me explain what it is, and then I'll explain what our strategy is. So the idea is that for certain tax credits, there are caps in the amount of tax credits that can be distributed every year. The one that's considered the most competitive, and it is the largest tax credit in the entire US regime of tax credits, is low-income housing tax credits that you mentioned. Incredibly valuable, and particularly in ones where there is high cost of construction, yet low returns. So that would be ones like the state of Connecticut, which has the same construction costs as New York City, but maybe half the rent or a quarter of the rent, depending on where you are. So those are the types of markets where low-income housing tax credits make a lot of sense. The issue is that there are limits to how much can be distributed. So depending on two parts, one is your ability to follow all the rules that are required in your application, and the other one is the quality of your application and your narrative. So that's essentially the two key pieces. For Redis, I want to be exceedingly honest. We're only a year and a half old. We're a technology company. We have 8 people. We're all really, we haven't solved every problem yet. We are now applying for tax credits for our first set of customers. So we are starting to get an intuition as to where the landmines lie in these types of applications. LIHTC is the hardest one for us. So that's the one that we are looking to do a few steps down the road. We're focusing on other tax credits right now, namely historic tax credits and new market tax credits. Those are the ones that we want to be able to master first, and then we'll find our way down there. So maybe, Sam, when I come on your show next year, I'll be able to tell you all the tricks and the secrets of LIHTC. But for now, we're going to have to suspend that one.
Great. And just for those of you who are listening, if you may not be familiar, LIHTC is LIHTC, which is low income housing tax credits. Let's hit these other two that you mentioned here and kind of break those down for us. And maybe, you know, we've been here bantering back and forth because I have a rudimentary understanding of it. Before we dig into that, can you just talk to us about the basic overarching, how does a tax credit work? What does it do for a developer? I mean, I'm sorry we left that out of this conversation because I'm probably further ahead maybe than some of our listeners are on this topic. So break that down for us, and then we'll go into these other last two, historic, and what was the other one you mentioned there?
New market tax credits, NMTC.
Yep.
Yeah. These are excellent questions. And I think that in many ways, real estate is like, if you guys remember high school biology, where it's a lot about memorizing a lot of things and terms and stuff, as opposed to the beauty of the idea. And I think it's important to remember the beauty of the idea and take a second to focus on that. And for someone that wants to make sure that their government spends their money responsibly, like I think any US citizen should, the tax credit is one of the most beautiful tools to encourage development without creating current monetary obligations for government. Let me explain to you the opposite of tax credit, and then we'll focus on tax credit. The opposite of a tax credit is a grant. And a grant means that the government takes our money and gives it to somebody else to do something, which means that there's a liability on the government's balance sheet because they literally just gave the money to somebody. There's this other creative tool called a tax credit, completely opposite side. It's this idea that, okay, yes. So corporations, for example, Fortune 500 companies will have relatively large tax obligations every year. Depending on who is in charge in the White House, it'll be anywhere from 28 to 38%. And that's a whole other conversation, corporate tax policy, but that's generally where it is. That's a lot of money if you're a Fortune 500 company. So the idea of a tax credit is to say, you know what? We have these certain things that we need to do. We need to have housing that's accessible to working class people. We need to have XYZ, all these other social goods that we need. We don't have the money to do it, and we can't tax our citizens at 100%. So what are we going to do? So what the idea of a tax credit is to say that we know that you, say, Kodak, or you, say, Google, or some other Fortune 500 company, owe us taxes every single year. What you can do is purchase a discounted obligation on your future tax by giving us current income to give to somebody else to make the social good that we want right now and we can't wait 10 years for. So let me give you an example. So low-income housing tax credits. So that is one that is typically syndicated, which means the movement of money that I just described. So government defines a certain amount of tax credits that are allowed for every single year. Then there's an entity called a syndicator, which says, hey, Google, hey, PPG, hey, Aluka, like whatever, like Fortune 500 company you want to fill in the blank, Citibank, we got tax credits for you and we know you got to pay taxes next year. Do you want to pay those taxes at 80%, 85%? Let's make a deal. So they are able to future pay, you could say, their tax obligations at a discount by giving that money right now for that syndicator then to give to people like your listeners that are developers and investors for them to use that money right now to make the affordable housing. That is what a tax credit is.
So in short, they are given, so let's say there's $1 million of taxes owed and you know, you can go out and buy $1 million in tax credits, but at a discount for 800, 850 grand. So
exactly,
shaving off 15% of the taxes that are owed. So it's an advantage to a corporation, but yet at the same time then gives funds to developers to go out and do projects that may not pencil out otherwise.
There certainly, I mean, by no means do I want to give the impression from a policy perspective, is this the like the perfect cure-all of every financial problem? Of course, there's nothing like that. But it's actually, when you take a moment to think about it, it's actually pretty genius, this idea, versus the idea of here, money, shower, take it all. So.
Right. And then on the syndicator's side, you know, what do they give other than having gone out and worked in order to secure the rights to those tax credits? What else do they have to give other than giving those tax credits and having a cash injection? Because now that that cash injection is coming to your company, that's not an equity stake that Citibank would have in the project. It's just, they're just buying a tax credit from you and they're out of the picture, right?
So they are actually involved in the overall capitalization of the deal. And it depends on how the syndication happens. It can sometimes be done as equity and it can sometimes be done as debt. It just depends on tax credit, deal by deal, syndicator by syndicator. But there is a stake that the typically limited partnership stake or a subordinate debt stake would be the most common that we've seen for that tax credit investor. So they do retain that. But the question that you asked was the syndicator and what their role is. So a syndicator essentially sits in the middle between the entities that are the important ones, which are the government, the Google, just the Google, and then the developer. So they are responsible for winning that the right to syndicate. So that comes from the government. Then they sell that to tax credit investors who give them the money. Then they distribute that by doing the due diligence and underwriting on deals. So they're not like Joe Schmo deals. They're actually good deals. And then making sure to do the checks, the auditing, the compliance to make sure that the deal, both in its sweep of construction and then during operations in a set period, complies with a certain set of rules in order for that tax credit not to get forfeited.
Gotcha. That's really fascinating. Man, a lot of moving pieces there. Mm-hmm. Let's jump here into the other two types of tax credits you guys are working on right now. You said one was new development and the other was historic.
Yeah, we'll do historic first. So to give you a gauge of sizes, so 100 billion we talked about. So a LIHTC, just rough numbers right now, changes every year. It's about 10 billion. So 10% of all of the incentives in the United States is LIHTC. That's a lot. The next one down is historic tax credits, approximately $7 billion a year. So tax credits for historic preservation and historic redevelopment are called historic tax credits. They are under the jurisdiction of, weirdly, the National Park Service. They're the ones that are responsible for this, as opposed to the U.S. Treasury or HUD, which do other tax credits. And their whole mandate is this, is that American history, about 250 years, there's things that we should preserve in order to remember, to celebrate, to keep and preserve what is American history, whether it might be a building that was around in New York City during the American Revolution, or one of the oldest buildings in the 1930s and 40s during the growth of LA, like a mid-century modern design, those things that tell the American story. And the idea is there might not always be a financial benefit to preserving a rundown building like that, particularly if it's like on Trinity Street downtown, which is super expensive. And there's better things to do than a four-story wood frame building from the 1700s. That's it. So the idea is that historic tax credits can allow to bridge that gap between the market and what these kind of social needs and desires are. And the idea is that if you maintain certain rules that the National Park Service sets up with your building, after having identified it as important historically, then you're able to get 20% of your qualified construction costs. So that's not all of your construction costs, there's certain types of construction costs can be converted into or have the ability to get tax credits against that 20%. That's historic tax credits.
Gotcha. Fascinating. Then on the new development side.
This one's called New Market Tax Credit, so NMTC, but it's the same idea. So we've talked about affordable housing, social good. Historic preservation, social good. Downtown revitalization, that is what New Market Tax Credits are. So for students of American history, it's the U.S. Highway Act and the GI Bill in the 1950s, plus a lot of municipal mismanagement across the Northeast is what caused the gutting of old industrial cities in terms of their population. Whether you're talking Newark, New Jersey, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, New York City, Boston, the list goes on and on and on. But the idea is that downtowns are really important because they allow a lot of people to come together to do something that is economically productive. That is the point of a downtown, to produce tax revenue. So New Market Tax Credits are meant to reverse this flood of money that went out from the 1940s to about the 2000s and encourage people to build, develop, maintain, grow their downtowns as economic engines. And the idea is that if you are doing something commercially oriented, so that is namely typically office, retail, something of that guise with a very small allocation for housing, it's not meant for housing, that type of activity, then you are able to get a tax credit. It's a little bit less structured in comparison to LIHTC, which is extremely structured, or historic, which is extremely structured. It has a little bit more give and take on what can be used and how it can be used, but it's meant for commercial real estate in downtowns. That's what new markets are. That's the third biggest tax credit. That's about $4 billion. We talked $10 billion, $7 billion, $4 billion.
Wow, that's absolutely fantastic. Atif, you've given us so much here to think about today. I mean, this has been very enlightening. I've loved this conversation. Thanks for taking the time to break this down. Let's jump here into the final four questions. Mm-hmm. What is one digital tool resource, thinking software here, that you find you can't live without?
This company called Redist. So kidding, I know it was a softball, but I think we talked about Redist already. I think let's talk about other tools that I cannot live without. You know, to be honest, I would say that real estate people, we are quite sophisticated. And I think we are quite cavalier in our ability to understand nuances of areas to invest and not to invest in strategies. But I like the fact that most real estate guys and gals, we don't overcomplicate it. And it's basically Excel. And like, if you're kind of a little bit fancy, maybe Google Drive, that's basically it. I mean, I think you can run a development business very well with Excel and Google Drive. So those are the two that I'd say.
Yep. Couldn't agree more. That's great. There's certainly things that make it easier, but you can get it done that way. That's for certain. If you could help our listeners avoid one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Okay. This is a good one. I feel like our industry is one where there's no barriers to entry. So literally, it's not like medicine where you got to go for a zillion years past the thing. Maybe to be an architect or engineer, yes, you have to do that and take the license. But in terms of being like a real estate agent or saying you're a developer or an investor, those aren't those types of things. Literally anybody can do it. And I think that there is this kind of fascination that our industry has and something that real estate media kind of pushes is this idea of a hypester or a con artist as the highest form of what our industry has. And this idea is that you lie, you cheat, you steal in order to get what you want. And that is something that should be celebrated. I think that's disgusting. And I think that if you are getting started in this industry, don't be wooed by people that are selling the $5, $15 ebook online or the $7,000 course at Madison Square Garden that you're supposed to go to, which you can't name because of COVID. Those type of things, don't be wooed into that, because a lot of that is about like the smoke and the mirrors and the image and all that stuff. Just go back to the basics of the things that your kindergarten teacher told you. Don't lie, don't cheat, don't steal. That's all you need to know.
I love it. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Okay, I'll say this, is I don't know if maybe your listeners will like this or not. It's the truth. So when you go to any sort of fancy real estate office in New York City, and that's, I'm saying that because that's what I know, that's where I'm from. It is very unlikely that you're going to find someone that looks like me in the office, which is strange because New York City is about 60% people of color and obviously about 50% female. And most real estate offices aren't 50% female. And I think that there is this easy answer to say, you know what, that's the way that it is because that's the way it's always been. And the most skilled and talented people were the ones that made it here. And that's the way that it is. I think that is a very cheap answer. And let me explain to you. So for my business, Redist, naturally, because we want people from the real estate industry to be our team members, very quickly, it was all dudes. And I mean, it was a lot of people of color because it was actually me and my friends, but it was a lot of dudes. And I'll use that as an example. And I thought for a second is that, is it important to have women in a company? I know it's a crazy thing to say, just verbalize it. Is it important to have women in a company? Of course, the answer should be yes, but just going through the mental exercise of it. Why is it important? And I'll tell you, when I hired my first employee, that was a woman, I came to realize that the way that we ran meetings subtly started changing. It was a lot less about people yelling at each other and starting to prove to each other why what they're saying is right. And there was finally a voice of reason in these meetings that would say, why are we doing it this way? Shouldn't we actually be doing it differently? And by no means am I trying to say that that is representative of an entire gender. But what I would say is that there is value in having different ways of communicating. There is value in having different ways of thinking, and there is values in having different ways of behaving. And I think that is not just like a equity, ESG, check the boxing. Like literally, I think the quality of a business improves when you have different people sharing different perspectives to get to the best end result. So I would say that's something that folks should be thinking about these days, I think.
Perfect. Love it. Atif, if our listeners want to get in touch with you or learn more about you, what is the best way to do that?
Best way would be on LinkedIn. I'm usually there all the times, frequently. So you could just DM me on LinkedIn. That's the easiest.
Fantastic. And of course, we'll put that link in the show notes as well. Thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it. This was great.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much and hope to catch you on the next episode.